A commonly overlooked but very important factor when M&A occurs is the human factor. What will happen to the employees? Does the acquirer wish to terminate staff, or perhaps to the contrary, they wish to ensure that staff stay and not leave? Thus, a good time to hear from Philip Schmidt, a partner and an employment law expert here at Arendt. Philip, good afternoon.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
No, well, thank you very much for being here. And seated on your left-hand side, we've got Laurent Schumer. Laurent, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And seated on your left-hand side, we've got Marc Mouton.
Good afternoon.
Now, Philippe, let's get straight to business. As we know that many mergers almost always lead to reorganisations, does the structure of the transaction have any impact from an employment law perspective?
Well, I would say for introductory comment that staff is indeed a key asset to a lot of businesses. You know, staff members, they have the knowledge, they have the client contact, the experience. They are basically the living memory of a given business. So the buyer obviously often wants to benefit from this unique asset along with the business which is acquired. And so mergers and acquisitions have very often an HR component to which we have to look at. I would say basically there are two different type of structures for this kind of transactions, one being a share deal, the other being an asset deal. For a share deal, there is not much implication from an employment law perspective because the buyer basically only buys the shares. There is no change in the identity of the employer. So you just have to involve the staff delegation for information and consultation purposes. But it is a whole other story when it comes to an asset deal, because there the identity of the employer changes, so there are, of course, much more implications.
Now, when it comes to M&A and the human factor, I've often heard this term 2P. What is this actually in practice?
Yeah, sure. Everyone talks about 2P. So 2P stands for Transfer of Undertaking and Protection of Employment. And basically, when it comes to an asset deal, I would say in almost 90% of the cases, you are facing a 2P process. So what is a transfer of undertaking? Well, basically, it is the transfer of an economic entity which retains its identity, meaning an organized grouping of resources, notably personnel and material, which has the objective of pursuing an economic activity which may be central or ancillary. So basically, you have three key conditions to face a 2P process. The first is the transfer of an economic entity which retains its identity. Second, pursuing an economic activity. And third, you need the transfer of a set of elements which is able to continue to transfer activity in autonomy. So in practice, it is a very factual analysis you have to do to make sure whether or not you are facing a 2P process. And it is often a complex question when it comes to partial transfers of undertaking.
Now, what are the consequences if this process is instigated?
Well, the most obvious consequence is that all existing employment agreements transfer automatically from the transferor to the transferee. So this means that the consent of the employees is not required, but on the other hand, they cannot object their transfer. So basically, the employment contracts are transferred as such from the transferor to the transferee. The working conditions of the employees must be upheld, or at least similar working conditions must be granted to the employees. So there must not be a substantial amendment to the terms and conditions of employment to the detriment during the transfer process. There are also some formalities to be respected. So basically, the transferor has to inform the transferee about the rights and obligations which are attached to the transferring employment agreements. This must be done in writing, and a copy of this notification needs to be shared with the Luxembourg Labour Supervisory Authority, the ITM. There are information and consultation obligations arising towards the staff delegation. You also need to inform the staff delegation in writing about certain elements of the transaction, like, for example, the date of the transaction, the reasons having led to the transaction. And this obligation needs to be faced by both the transferee and the transferor. And if the transferor or the transferee envisage any measure towards the employees due to the 2P process, they have to consult with their respective staff representatives and to get their agreement.
Now, you've talked about the consequences of 2P there. I'd like to come back to this topic of the the entity that's doing the acquisition, and then who may wish to reorganize the staff. Are there any specific restrictions there that they should be aware of?
Yes, there are, of course, two major restrictions. The first restriction results from the labor code. As you may know, when you terminate an employee, you have to give the reasons why you are terminating the employee. And the labor code says that employees cannot be made redundant or cannot be terminated based on the sole reason of the transfer of undertaking. So it is, as such, not a valid reason for terminating the employees. You can, of course, have other reasons for termination related to the TUPE, but the TUPE as such is not the reason for dismissal. And in the financial sector, you may face an additional obstacle, which is the collective bargaining agreement applicable to bank employees, which foresees that employees who have been subject to a TUPE process cannot be made redundant during a 2 years period following the TUPE process, and the terms and conditions of employment cannot be substantially amended. And now we have seen just last Friday that a new version of the collective bargaining agreement has been negotiated, and the major terms and conditions have been made available to the public. And there we see that this restriction is upheld also in the future collective bargaining agreement.
I mean, so what you're saying here, it seems as though employees, they do actually get quite a lot of protection. Is that fair to say? I might open that question up to our panel. Do you think that employees get enough protection, Laura?
Well, I don't know whether it's a question of getting enough protection or not enough protection. There is this protection that is around, and it is certainly legitimate. And it requires planning, because where Philip says this applies, of course, in the asset deal, and there are procedures to be followed. In a share deal, you have also HR issues, because if two companies in the regulated sector do get together, they will possibly merge with each other. You may have two compliance officers, two risk officers, two general counsels, and things like that. So you may double your functions. And there is a question of how do I handle that? And the best negotiations I've seen is where parties were very clear from the start what they want to achieve as a result and how they are going to get there, respecting labor law, treating the employees in a fair manner, because there's also a reputation at stake for the buyer and the seller, but at the same time making it clear, here is the result where we want to get to, and that's part of the communication, that's part of the deal, that's part of what we want to achieve. So here, communication is very important, as well as preparation, of course, but communication is important.
Mark, is the regulator concerned by this sort of topic?
Yes, I think it's probably a bit of a planning item as well, because, for instance, if you, in an asset deal, we have seen you may take over a business together with a set of employees, but also potentially the kind of a senior manager in charge of this field, maybe with a compliance officer, with a specialized risk officer. And you know, often you may wish to give these people also, let's say, a senior function within the acquirer, so who will buy this business. And here it's just important, of course, to remember that if you want to appoint kind of these employees to a senior function within the buyer, the acquirer, you need some regulatory approvals for these persons to be nominated to this function. So it's also important to anticipate that. So for instance, if you want to be sure that, let's say, a very important manager of this business, you also keep him for the distance, because, of course, on the one hand, the employees are protected, but they may also, you know, choose to go their different ways if they are not convinced of the project of the acquirer. So you may want to offer them certain functions also. And there it's just important also, if you want this to become effective really immediately after the transaction, then you also need to prepare kind of the regulatory approvals, so be it as a chief compliance officer, as an authorized manager or so. You just need to make sure that you got these regulatory approvals in advance. And I would say on the seller side, also you have to be careful, of course, because you will be selling part of your business, and you just need to make sure that in terms of staff also that will remain, that you, let's say, keep also the key functions you need from a regulatory perspective to continue your business, that you still have the right level of substance and so forth. So I would say it's indeed also an area where you need to keep the regulatory angle in mind when structuring the deal.
Now, Philippe, I'm sure there are some companies that are interested in conducting acquisitions, and all of this sounds like far too much hassle. From your perspective, what practical advice could you give to a buyer with regards to a reorganization?
Well, we have seen before the different restrictions that you are facing, being the restrictions resulting from the labor code or the collective bargaining agreement. So for the buyer, the ideal timing would be restructuring before closing, so that basically it is the transferor, so the seller who has to carry out the restructuring. And we see in practice that this is always an essential element in the context of the negotiations between the seller and the buyer, so it has definitely an impact on the price as well. And in a nutshell, the party to the transaction who will have to carry out the restructuring will face some kind of exposure towards the employees. So there is also a financial component to this, and this is very often part of the negotiation between the seller and the buyer trying to decrease the price, of course, for the company that he is buying, because he will face some exposure due to that employment restructuring.
Now, what about on the flip side? If I was a benevolent business owner, I'm selling my business, but I don't want my staff to be made redundant following a transaction. Is there anything I can do as a seller to protect my staff?
Well, that's a good point, because we see that very often there is a very strong link and relationship between the seller and its staff. So the seller wants to make sure that those persons are protected. So what can the seller do? Basically, there is good news because he can do something to protect them, but there is also bad news because it comes at a certain cost. So in case the buyer intends to make redundancies, the seller might refrain him from doing so and ask him to offer guarantees of employment. But of course, the buyer will want to see compensations for this in the form of monetary compensations. So I would say there is almost no limit to the contractual freedom between the seller and the buyer in this respect, but it's at the end of the day all a question of negotiation between the parties.
Laurent.
Chad, just on that point, in my experience is, if you want to safeguard your employees, do prepare that a little bit in advance of the transaction, because if you come during the transaction by trying to insert some of these clauses or doing some of this, the price is going to be much higher than if a certain situation is already in place where you've prepared for that and said, there are in my employment agreement certain provisions which do already contain some degree of protection in case of an M&A transaction.
So it appears, once again, it's a case of good planning. It seems to be part, an essential element.
Planning is everything, as we've seen.
So to conclude, Philippe, if you had to summarize, what are some of the key points here that you would wish potential companies that might be going to conduct an acquisition to think about from an employment law perspective?
Well, of course, the human resources are an important aspect to such transaction. We have seen the TUPE process. This is really a major milestone in this kind of transactions. And as Laurent said before, you have to plan ahead. You need to know where you want to go. You need to see what is the objective that you want to achieve. And I think something which is very important as well is carrying out a proper due diligence just to make sure that you avoid any surprises. You might have employment agreements with for example, change of control clauses or other protective benefits for the employee. So it's important to keep that in mind. So as a conclusion, I would say that there is no thing such as a free lunch, certainly not when it comes to mergers and acquisitions.
Philippe Schmidt, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.